Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Are you obsessed with the presidential race? Me too. We will talk presidential politics later in the hour, specifically how Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is doing in office after using some of the same uplifting campaign rhetoric as Barack Obama to get elected. What happens once he's actually in the governing business? So that's coming up later this hour. But first, believe it or not, it's not too early to talk about next year's New York City mayoral race. Can you believe it's already only a year away as Mayor Bloomberg hits his term limit? One candidate who has already unofficially signaled her likely intentions is City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, who was also in the news this month for giving her own version of a State of the City address, which the speaker typically does. And she joins me now to talk about politics, policy, and life in New York. Speaker Quinn, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thank you very much. Good morning.
The theme of your speech was that in this economic downturn, getting leaner does not have to mean getting meaner.
Yes.
Is that something you've been worried about under Mayor Bloomberg?
No, I've not at all been worried about that under Mayor Bloomberg. But when you head into tough economic times, you have to be mindful of that. You have to be aware of what your important responsibilities are. You have to be aware that even when there are times that you may have to cut the budget, there are some kind of moral lines in the sand that you can't cross, and you have to be more creative and more innovative to make sure you don't cross them. You know, I think a lot, the mayor has demonstrated that type of innovation and creativity during his term, and I want to make sure as we go into tough times over at least the next 2 years, we're even more committed to that type of innovation. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now we have over 2 million New Yorkers who are on Medicaid, who are on public health insurance programs. We only have 1.1 million New Yorkers who are on food stamps. Now, the eligibility requirements for the two are almost identical. So what we announced in the speech is we're going to do something that is going to cost basically nothing, but makes a lot of sense. We're going to data match the two lists, find out who on that list gets Medicaid but doesn't get food stamps, then reach out to them and help them enroll. I mean, I guess you could argue some of those folks know they're eligible and don't want it, but that's not really the truth. The truth is the folks don't know they're eligible. And in tough times, being smart, using things like technology and then reaching out to those New Yorkers and enrolling them will help them, A, won't cost us money, and C, will bring in federal money, which is what we get when folks get mm-hmm. food stamps
now,
that can really help them.
Now, is everybody who's eligible for Medicaid necessarily also eligible for food stamps?
No, it's not 100% the same eligibility requirements, but they're very, very close. So it won't be a one-for-one match, but given that there's, you know, over a million more people enrolled in Medicaid than in food stamps, there's a big chunk of those that are eligible. Because right now, there's probably about 500,000 New Yorkers at least out there eligible for food stamps and not enrolled. So it's not one-to-one, but mm-hmm. they're very similar eligibility.
Right. You would think that there would be some kind of an automatic question that comes up in the Medicaid enrollment process since there is such an overlap. So that's an interesting thing if there isn't. Now, let's go through some of the other things that you brought up in the speech real
okay.
quick about what the council and the mayor can work on despite the economic downturn. You mentioned tax cuts, improved transportation, more of a certain kind of pay for teachers, and affordable housing. I want to run through a few of these
okay.
things. Your tax cut proposal is a specific one-week sales tax thing?
Yes. You know, the federal government has put in place these rebates that folks are probably going to get in the summertime. Now, we can debate whether or not that was the best thing for the federal government to do, but it's done. And if we want, when those checks get here, for them to actually be a stimulus to the economy, we have to compel people to spend that money. And these rebates are generally going to higher income New Yorkers versus lower income New Yorkers. So we want to go out there and compel people to spend the money. What's a way to do that? to waive the sales tax on items in the city for a week. We did this type of thing after September 11th. It can be very effective, and it can really help businesses in the city and actually give the economy
right.
a shot in the arm.
Now, they're actually going primarily to middle-income New Yorkers, right? Because people over a certain
Correct.
Income actually
Correct.
Are not eligible for the rebates. But
and also people who are very much lower income are not eligible for the rebates.
Right.
Either. So it's not like you're taking somebody. My point is kind of you're not taking somebody who's probably with very, very limited income, where it would be better for them to save the money.
Mm-hmm.
We're not in trying to entice those kind of folks to spend money they
right.
should save.
Right. And I see your point about trying to get people with the sales tax suspension to at least spend the money in New York City if they're going to
exactly.
spend the money. But the mayor's office, I've read, is skeptical of this because of the loss of revenue to the city, the sales tax revenue, during a fiscal crunch when their revenues are down.
You know, the mayor and I will continue to discuss this sales tax free week idea as we move into the budget negotiations, which will start in the near future. And obviously, any time in tough fiscal times, you have to balance not spending or waiving revenue with the need to stimulate the economy. It's a balance. And you can't do too much of overspending or tax cutting in tough times, but you also need to consider doing some of it because that's what can help stimulate the economy. So it's a balance.
And on pay for teachers, you're proposing a kind of tough assignment pay for teachers?
Basically, you know, the idea would be that we recognize, that we admit that it's harder to get teachers to go and stay in some schools than others. Middle schools are the most challenging places to get really good, highly qualified, experienced teachers to go. And middle schools that are low performing for whatever reason are the toughest of the tough to get the best to go to. So we want to put in place a bonus pay, if you will. Money, extra money that a teacher would get if they went to or stayed at a low-performing middle school and really committed to bringing their tremendous experience and skill to that school.
How do you think Mayor Bloomberg and Chancellor Klein have done generally with their school reforms?
You know, I think that Mayor Bloomberg and Chancellor Klein have done very well in the past 6 years under their leadership. You know, our schools are doing much better than they had been doing. Now, that said, they're nowhere near as good as anyone wants them to be. Not myself, not the mayor, not the chancellor. And we need to keep working and being vigilant about helping our schools move forward.
They get a lot of criticism for too much standardized testing.
They do. But, you know, we also have to recognize this past year, for example, we were the winners of the Broad Achievement Award. It's one of the highest national educational awards, singling out New York City for the first time as the urban educational system that had the biggest closing of the achievement gap. That's a very significant accomplishment. I mean, when before has New York City's public education system been heralded on a national level? That's a step forward.
So a third term for Chancellor Klein or someone like him would be likely if Christine Quinn became mayor?
Well, there's a lot packed into that question, Brian. You know, I think we need a person at the helm of our educational system who's very focused on our children and focused on making sure that every child, whatever school they walk into, whatever neighborhood they're in, whether it's a low-income neighborhood or a high-income neighborhood, has the same highest quality education, that we need to make sure that a school continues to move in the direction that we're headed in this city, which is that a school is a school, and that the quality of your education shouldn't be determined by what neighborhood you live in. And I think we've made great progress in that area, and we need to keep moving, though we're not done, but we are making progress.
New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, my guest on WNYC. We can take some phone calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. How has affordable housing been impacted, if at all yet, by this economic downturn? Is it, in a way, a good thing for affordable housing that the housing market is going a little bit south?
Well, you know, the housing market potentially going south is complicated. You know, maybe that has the potential of rents going down. You don't know. It obviously also has a negative on our overall economic situation as well. I don't think, though, even in an economic downturn, we will see the type of relief, particularly for renters, that we really need, the type of relief that would, you know, undercut the changes and that have occurred because of the erosion to rent protections in this city.
Last year in your State of the City, if I recall correctly, you proposed a renter's tax credit.
Yes.
For people making under a certain amount of money.
Yes.
And it did not go through.
It did not go through. It's still part of what we're pushing for in Albany. We would need to get permission from Albany to do that. What we would like is Albany to give us that power legislatively. The Assembly passed the bill last year. We would need the State Senate to pass it. What we would do, though, in the bill is say, give the Council the power to enact this when it's the right economic time for us to do it in the city. You know, what the point of the renter's tax credit was we have, for a number of years now, given homeowners a $400 rebate on their property taxes to try to give them some of the money they gave the city after 9/11 back. Renters pay property taxes. It gets passed along through the Rent Guidelines Board. In fact, the Rent Guidelines Board regulations require that it be considered in raising rent. But property owners, landlords, don't ever go and reduce rents once the property tax rate goes down or gets frozen. And we need to find a way to help renters who helped the city when they had to pay higher property taxes.
Let's take a phone call. And my guest again, the New York City Council Speaker, Christine Quinn. You talked about the Medicaid and food stamp eligibility, and Sherry in the Bronx wants to talk about that. Hi, Sherry.
Okay. Hi there. I had a comment in regards to the food stamp eligibility. I have Medicaid, and I had to retire early because of a disability. And I am not eligible for food stamps because the way it was explained to me is I do not have dependents. So as
the fact that you don't have singles can qualify for food stamps. Now, we'd need to look at the specifics of your financial case. So if you would give the folks on the show your name and phone number, I'll have my office call you back and set up a conference call with my office and some a group we work with called Food Change, and they can take your information and we can figure out whether or not you got the right information in saying that you weren't eligible.
Okay.
Okay, Sherry. So hang on. I'm putting you on hold.
Thank you.
Can we get Sherry's number off the air and give it to the speaker's office?
By the way,
this leaner but meaner, but not meaner theme, how much leaner does the city have to get? How bad do you see the downturn becoming?
Well, you know, we don't 100% know yet. You know, the mayor's preliminary budget has cuts targeted to different city agencies. We will begin reviewing those cuts at the beginning of March in our budget hearings. We'll know more about what next year will look like come April when we get the next round of economic numbers.
And that fiscal year begins July 1st.
Correct.
So do you see any particular flashpoints between the council and the mayor in this negotiation for this budget?
Well, it's never easy when you don't have enough money. But I think all of us on both sides of the building recognize we have to have a balanced budget, and we have to balance a budget in a way that's smart for the long term, but does everything it can to make sure you protect core services and do that in smart ways. You know, one of the things we also called for in the State of the City was having the Department of Education begin competitively bidding their school bus contracts. Now, why is that important in a tough budget like this? We spend $1 billion a year on school bus contracts. We're one of the only cities in America that doesn't competitively bid. In the late 80s, when Liz Holtzman was comptroller, she did an audit. She believed then we could save $100 million a year if we competitively bid school bus contracts. Mm-hmm. Think of what we could save now. That's money you could put back into the Department of Education and not have to take out of our school system.
You know, Governor Corzine, in his budget address today in New Jersey, is proposing an actual budget cut for the next fiscal year to deal with their deficit. In New York, you know, you just cut back on the rate of increase. Does the city have to be tougher like this Corzine proposal to really deal with harder times?
Well, you know, we're going to have to look at all of those questions in the months between now and the end of June when we have to pass the budget. You know, one of the things we've pushed for that would deal with the rate of growth issue is the ability to have a rainy day fund. By law, we have to have a balanced budget. We have to spend, in some way or another, every dollar that comes in. So as we have more revenues, we have to spend them. That's the way we've been structured as a result of the Financial Control Act of the 70s. If we had the ability to actually pull money aside, put it in a savings account, if you will, we might have other options. Now, even with those limitations, last year, the mayor and the council paid down over $1 billion worth of this year's debt last year. And even though this year will be tough, we will probably still pay some of next year's debt this year, because the year after next looks even worse. But we would be better off if we could actually put some money aside and not only have the option of prepaying future debt.
Diane.
And that's why we've pushed for Albany, who would have to give us the authority to allow us to create a rainy day fund.
Diana in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with City Council Speaker and likely mayoral candidate for next year, Christine Quinn. Hi, Diana.
Hi. Hi, Chris. It's Diana Montfort.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi. I'm calling to ask about affordable housing for trans people. My landlord, I live in a rent-stabilized every side apartment. My landlord is desperately trying to get rid of me so he can raise the rent to $3,000 a month. Transgender people have a terrible time with landlords. What will you do for us if you're mayor?
Well, first of all, if you're being harassed by your landlord, you know, I will have my office call you right away. Actually, in the very near future, we are going to be passing a piece of legislation in the City Council, a Tenant Protection Act. And for the first time ever, when this act goes into law, which will be very soon, the tenants will have the right to take their landlord to court if they are harassing them. Up until now, you could take your landlord to court every time they turned off your heat or your hot water, but if they were doing it deliberately to harass you, you didn't have standing in court for that. And I think that bill would unfortunately maybe help the situation you're in, but will help countless tenants who are being harassed by their landlords, who know that if they get them out because of vacancy decontrol, they can raise the rent. So that's one important thing we're going to put into law to protect tenants. You know, we're also announced two very important things as it relates to affordable housing in the State of the City speech. We have partnered with our Central Labor Council. They have put together a very impressive nonprofit entity. The council and this nonprofit are going to work together. We're going to approach building owners as they're buying out of programs like Mitchell-AMA and use the resources of the Central Labor Council's nonprofit, the bank accounts, the pension funds that are part of that, and also the resources the city can bring to the table, tax abatements, et cetera, to try to purchase those buildings instead of the owners buying out. Also, go to developers to partner with them with the resources of the AFL-CIO's Housing Trust to build new affordable housing in the City of New York.
And she was asking about gay and lesbian, transgender in particular, right?
Well, I don't think there's any housing that's particularly going to be developed for LGBT people or non-LGBT people.
Or to help them with landlord harassment, I think she was saying.
In the city, there's two things that can happen as it relates to LGBT issues in housing. One is the human rights law, which, thanks to the activism of people like Diana and others in the LGBT community, we now have a fully inclusive human rights law in the city that includes transgender people. So one, if the nature of the harassment is about gender identity or sexual orientation, that can be taken to the Human Rights Commission. If the nature of the harassment is about being a tenant, which is, I think what Diana, you were saying is with your landlord, and they want to push you out because they can jack the rent up, our tenant protection law will now cover that. And actually, one of the things that really compelled the tenant protection law forward was a couple that I was with one day in court in Brooklyn, a lesbian couple with a young child. They were being harassed by their landlord in a three-family apartment. He was harassing them exclusively because of their sexual orientation. They were able to take him to court under the human rights law. Now they can take him to court under the human rights law and under the tenant harassment law. But Diana, we'll reach out to you about the particulars of your landlord to see what can be done.
By the way, we're looking at all these firsts in the presidential race. You would be the first woman, first lesbian, and first Irish also. I'm not sure if that's right. Mayor of New York. Do you see those things as milestones, issues, or irrelevant?
Well, there's been an Irish mayor.
Who am I forgetting here?
O'Dwyer.
Oh, okay.
Right. I am the first Irish speaker, though, which we always add into the list of things because it makes my father particularly happy.
I knew you were the first Irish something.
You know, I am very focused right now on the long list of things we're talking about and the long list of work I have to do over the next 2 years as Speaker. But obviously, we've seen in this presidential election that it is incredibly exciting in this country when you think about communities that have never been at particular levels of elected office and that they are now within striking distance of having the most important job in the country, if not the most important job in the world. That is energizing. And it's exciting because it means that there's young women out there, young people of color out there, young LGBT people out there who see role models and see that the sky's the limits for them. And it's wonderful to be in a city and a country where that type of thing is happening.
We have a few minutes left with City Council Speaker Christine Quinn. We'll do those few minutes coming right up, and then we will go live to Massachusetts to see how the governor there, Deval Patrick, is doing in office, actually governing after running on some rhetoric similar to Barack Obama's. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn for another few minutes, then live to Massachusetts. You've heard about this so-called plagiarism issue involving Obama's language reflecting Deval Patrick's language from when he was running for governor as Massachusetts. He's a national chairman of the Obama campaign. Well, we're gonna go beyond that whole thing and look at how someone who campaigned on inspirational speeches as Deval Patrick did is doing when he actually gets into the governor's chair. So that'll come up in just a few minutes. But to finish up with Christine Quinn, a couple of things real quick. You were a leading opponent of Mayor Bloomberg's West Side Stadium plan, which was in your West Side Council District.
Yes, now, and I won.
And you won, and your allies. And now you and Governor Spitzer are at odds over his plan to sell some of the land over there that was slated for expansion of the Javits Center. Briefly, what's your objection?
Well, you know, the convention industry is an incredibly important one for New York City, even more now as we're heading into economic downtimes. You know, if we had a 21st century first-class convention center, that could mean 6,000 more jobs and over $20 million more a year at least in city and state revenue. And these are construction jobs, tourism jobs, hotel jobs. These are good middle-class jobs that people could support their families on.
The governor says he could get $900 million for the land. That's a lot of years at $20 million and use it for things like Governor's Island development and citywide affordable housing.
You know, if the governor thinks that where Javits is isn't the best place for a convention center and wants to sell that land, we can consider moving the convention center somewhere else. But the governor's talking about basically, albeit a big one, I'd heard $400 million, not $900 million, okay. But either way, big money, real money, it's a one-shot. It's not something that's consistently part of the budget and consistently supporting families and middle-class neighborhoods. The governor can't sell off that property, sell off any chance of having a really competitive convention center without having a plan. for where our convention center will be, a convention center that's actually competitive. If we want to move it somewhere else, it's in my home district, but it doesn't have to be there. But let's explore that. Let's have a plan. Putting a Band-Aid on a convention center that isn't working.
There have been press reports that you and the governor had a screaming match about this, especially that he went off on you in his famous way. What's your version of that exchange?
The governor and I have had a couple of very professional conversations about the convention center. We each feel strongly about our position, but there was no screaming and no carrying on between myself and the governor.
No screaming on either party's part?
You know, I'm loud. I'm from New York. But no, there was no screaming.
We have Silda Spitzer, the governor's wife, on the show tomorrow.
Oh, I thought you were going to say she was calling in.
No. But can you imagine being married to someone with a temper like he's supposed to have?
Well, you know, you can ask my partner, Kim, you know.
You came under some criticism for spending $12,000 of taxpayer money on an outside speechwriter for this State of the City address. You and your staff couldn't do it on existing salaries?
You know, we don't have a speechwriter on staff. I really only give one or so big speeches a year. So it wouldn't make sense for us to spend a full speechwriter's staff and benefits to have them on salary all year long to write one speech. It has always been the customer, the process here in the council, that the speaker gives a state of the city and they hire an outside consultant to write that speech, because it is a much better and smaller use of money to do that than to have a full-time speechwriter on staff. Now, I feel very strongly that we in the council have to lead by example in tough economic times. And that's why in the State of the City speech, I said for the first time ever this year, when the council is writing its budget for next year, whatever level of cuts the city agencies end up having to bear, whether that's 2, 3, 4, 5%, it doesn't matter. Whatever we're going to have to cut from city agencies, we're going to cut that from the city council. And that's really about using money wisely and leading by example. I'm not going to ask a teacher to do more with less unless I'm going to also do more with less.
Last thing, Mayor Bloomberg has earned a reputation as an independent. And a lot of people who are skeptical of this politically unknown, politically inexperienced billionaire swooping in and kind of buying the election now think he has been extremely competent and extremely independent of the usual donors and the usual interests. Would it have to be back to old-fashioned interest group coalition building if you or any of the other, Democrats who came up through the usual way get into office?
You know, I think in the past 2 years of being speaker, you know, I've demonstrated a tremendous ability to get things done in this building and to really focus the city council on progress and delivering for New Yorkers, and have moved the council away from a tradition of being defined by politics and fighting with the mayor for the sake of fighting. We also, in these past 2 years, have reformed lobbying laws, have passed landmark campaign finance laws that really limit the ability of those doing business with the city of New York in the long term to give contributions to people running for office. We've reformed the rules of the city council to make it a more even playing field, so nobody can say, well, my bills didn't get passed because the speaker likes me or doesn't like me. So we've taken great steps in these past 2 years to demonstrate the council and make the council a really independent legislative body. And I hope whoever the next leaders are in this city continue moving government forward with an idea towards independence and being focused not on the needs of lobbyists, but on the needs of average New Yorkers who shouldn't have to and can't hire lobbyists to represent them.
New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, thanks a lot for coming on.
Sure.
With us.
Take care.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with the words of Deval Patrick and the words of Barack Obama.
I am not asking anybody to take a chance on me. I'm asking you to take a chance on your own aspirations.
I'm not just asking you to take a chance on me. I'm also asking you to take a chance on your own aspirations.
Well, Barack Obama on the campaign trail, preceded there by Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick when he was running, last year. We are not going to rehash now the plagiarism charge by the Clinton campaign regarding that shared rhetoric, but Patrick is a national chairman of the Obama campaign, and the influence is clear. And Patrick, who won election partly on rhetoric similar to Obama's, is now in office. So what we will talk about now is what happens once a candidate who uses inspiring speeches to get elected actually begins to govern on the nuts and bolts. Now here, in case you haven't heard it, is another example of Patrick and Obama in their respective campaigns.
But her dismissive point, and I hear it a lot from her staff, is that all I have to offer is words. Just words. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. Just words. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Just words. Ask not what your country can do for you.
Don't tell me words don't matter. I have a dream. Just words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Just words. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Just words. Just speeches.
Deval Patrick campaigning last year, Barack Obama campaigning recently with me. And by the way, we will play Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton echo, let's say, coming up in a few minutes. But with me now to talk about the Patrick governorship is Mike Tice, a reporter for public station WBUR in Boston. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's Fred, Brian.
Fred Tice. I'm sorry. And Fred, first, I don't want to portray the two campaigns as more similar than they were just based on those two clips. And I'm pretty unfamiliar with how Patrick ran for office. How similar have these two campaigns been?
They have been extremely similar. Patrick, as you could hear just from the clips there, Patrick did campaign on an idea of hope. He also very much wanted to tell people that it was time to do things in a different way, and he wanted to energize Democrats here by saying that it was time to sort of ditch trying to work with Republicans or to try to work to basically respond to Republicans and to come up with their own agenda. And that's how he energized people here.
Who was the opponent Patrick was referring to in his clip who denounced his rhetoric as just words?
The opponent was the lieutenant governor at the time, Carrie Healey, who was the Republican candidate for governor, and Patrick trounced her in the election.
And she did kind of what Hillary Clinton is doing now, saying words are not solutions and we can't change anything by saying we'll all get along.
Absolutely. And Patrick came back and would come back with this rhetoric that you've heard, but he would also tie it to talking to people who are on the edge. Very much his message was people who are poor people who are in broken schools, people who faced a broken healthcare system and had lost their hope, and middle class people who were afraid of becoming poor. These were images that he would bring back very often in his campaign.
Did Patrick also have a strong policy platform during the campaign? Did he come in for this criticism that Obama does, that he was too general?
You know, while he did come under criticism, as you've pointed out, he also had a very strong policy platform. He campaigned very heavily on having more mass transit in the state, on building new commuter rail lines. That was something that he emphasized over and over again as he went around the state. Also, clean energy, wind power, it's a big issue in Massachusetts because we're trying to decide whether to have a big wind farm out in Nantucket Sound, and he came out squarely in favor of that. He definitely had a strong policy agenda when he was campaigning to go with his words.
So he had the words, he had the policy platform, he talked about unity, he talked about hope, reaching across the aisle, he trounced his Republican opponent, as you said. How's it working out?
Well, he had some stumbles. When he first came into office a year ago, I think Patrick became the victim of the fact that he disdains politics. It's kind of an odd thing for someone who's in politics, but he disdains the political considerations of things. And he came in, and it was time to get some new curtains and furniture for the office and also to buy a new vehicle for the governor. He followed the advice that he was given and bought a Cadillac, which is what the state troopers wanted him to buy. And people warned him that this would look bad, and he disdained that kind of advice because he felt that the right thing to do was to follow the advice he was given. It was the right vehicle. It was the right thing to do to redo the governor's office. And he got in a lot of trouble because appearances ended up mattering. I think it may have come as a shock to him. And he has expended a lot of political capital in the past year doing something that no one had expected. He had run saying that he opposed casino gambling as a source of revenue, but that he was open-minded about the issue. Well, now he's the state's foremost proponent of bringing casino gambling to Massachusetts.
Huh.
And he's really spending all his political capital on that one issue, trying to bring the state legislature around, the state legislature which is opposed to casino gambling. And I think a lot of the people who supported him initially see him frittering away his political capital on an issue that he hadn't even campaigned on.
Anybody from Massachusetts listening right now? Some of you on the web, I know our signal occasionally goes right up the Sound all the way to Martha's Vineyard, so maybe some people out on the Cape can get us on AM 820. Anyone else listening on the web? Anybody with just ties to Massachusetts here in the New York area who have been following the Patrick administration and any similarities or differences with the Barack Obama campaign, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, or just your questions for Fred Tice from WBUR Boston, 212-433-9692. And let's take a call right now. Richard in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Brian. I wanted to first off commend you for covering this story. I think this has generally been underreported in the media. Two things. One, Obama made a quip in the campaign about not knowing who he was running against, Bill or Hillary, which got a lot of positive play in the media, but it seems like there's a deeper question about whether or not Obama is the authentic he pretends to be, and whether or not Deval Patrick really is the candidate perhaps running on the ticket for president unbeknownst to voters. I'd like to get feedback on that. And secondly, the thing that's troubling about the words lifted isn't that he, you know, again, uses other people's as resources, but it's that attribution is such an easy, low-cost effort thing to do. It essentially takes putting a clause of in the words of in front of whatever you're about to say. So when somebody doesn't consciously make that effort, it's troubling because it is such a low-cost thing to do.
Right. Okay. Well, but mostly in this segment, we're really talking about Deval Patrick, but I guess people will have their opinions, and Richard, you're certainly entitled to yours about the ethics of using these words in these various ways. Has this become a big thing in Massachusetts, Fred? Has the governor been asked about it?
He certainly has been asked about it, and he's been very generous, of course, because he's supporting Barack Obama. He's come out and said that Barack Obama was free to borrow any of his words, he said that it's not a big deal.
And Richard, are you still there?
I am.
You know what? We were gonna play this a little later, but why don't we play it right now? This is Bill Clinton in the 1992 campaign and Hillary Clinton in the debate on CNN last Thursday.
When the history of this campaign is written, they may say, well, Bill Clinton took a lot of hits in this campaign. But I want you to know something. The hits that I took in this election, nothing compared to the hits that the people of this state and this country are taking every day of their lives under this administration.
You know, the hits I've taken in life are nothing compared to what goes on every single day in the lives of people across our country.
So, Richard, do you care? Richard, oh, did we lose Richard? There we go. Richard, is that the same thing?
Yeah, well, I've heard that clip. I'm one of these obsessed political people you were talking about earlier. I think it's similar. I don't think it's the same thing. Again, I think the where again you insert different phrases and clauses into a generally similar thematic, I think you do legitimately create a different, not direct quote. I think the in the Obama earlier thing, and again, I don't care so much about the content. It's more there that there it was such a whole passage being listed in almost verbatim and in tone and tenor, right, that to not simply say, you know, but in the words of my good friend Deval Patrick, you know, words do matter, or, you know,
Richard,
you know, quotes that he used, you know, those are just words, you know,
I gotcha.
Again, just put that little phrase in front, it would have been fine.
Okay. Thanks for your call. And Martha in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I'm interested, sort of relating back to your question of how's it going.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the Massachusetts health care plan. I've been watching it as closely as I can, but I can't get my hands on much national news about it. And the question I have is basically, how's it going? I know that it was instituted by Mitt Romney, but I'm wondering how it's going under Patrick.
Fred, how about that? We just can't keep governors of Massachusetts out of this race.
it's going extremely well. I think the problems that have arisen out of the fact that an unexpected number of people signed up for it. They just never anticipated so many people would sign up. And so there are some questions about how we're going to fund it from here on out. Nothing insurmountable, but it's really seems to have been quite a big success. Huh. One of the worries had been how many young men you could get, in particular men under 35, and even in that category, they've been surprised by how many people have joined in.
Now, when you
in.
Say signed up and joined in, you're talking about mostly young, employed but uninsured men and some women who now are required under the so-called Romney Care, required to go out and buy health insurance as individuals or face a tax penalty, and they're doing it. Is that basically what you're saying?
That's right. It seems like a surprising number of people have come out of the woodwork and are signing up. If you're below the poverty level, of course, then you're going to be covered by the state, by the Medicaid money that the state receives. But if you're above that particular level, you've got to go out and you've got to pay for it yourself. And the folks who put this in place, the legislators, are quite surprised by how many people have opted to join in, how many uninsured people there really were out there, more than they initially thought.
Which gets back to another flashpoint issue between Clinton and Obama that I'm sure we'll hear about again in the Ohio debate tonight. And by the way, we will be carrying that debate at 11 o'clock tonight on AM 820 WNYC. And that, of course, the issue of whether it should be required for individuals not otherwise covered to buy health insurance. When we continue in a minute, I want to ask you if you think there's any reflection on Patrick that Clinton won the Massachusetts primary, whether there was a sense among Massachusetts Democrats of, oh, we've heard this uplifting rhetoric before, but now we know what it looks like in office. So we'll get to that in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.